Let's go back in time a little to a chilly morning. It's November 2019, and a group of people have gathered in Hyde Park to memorialize the past.
The Grimke sisters believed in the value of dignity for every single human being. They spent their entire lives speaking out against slavery and fighting for women's suffrage. In Boston, we're making sure their story's told. We're dedicating this bridge as a commemoration and also a call to action. The work is not finished, not by a long shot.
That was former Boston mayor and current Secretary of Labor Marty Walsh dedicating the then newly reconstructed Dana Avenue Bridge to Sarah and Angelina Grimke. The sisters are internationally recognized as abolitionists, champions of women's rights, and a lot of that fame is linked to Boston, where they lived for years. So here's the thing. As is so often the case, most looks at the Grimke sisters, are incomplete. Raised in a slaveholding family, given social status by that family, advocates for change, but not too much change. And women in a family whose name and legacy were reclaimed by black nephews born in slavery. Tufts historian Carrie Greenidge sets out to narrate a more complete picture in her latest book, The Grimkes, The Legacy of Slavery in an American Family. And in doing so, she weaves myriad threads of slavery, liberation, violence, escape, wealth, race, and pre- and post-antebellum America. Greenidge is an assistant professor in the Department of Studies in Race, Colonialism, and Diaspora at Tufts University and co-directs the African American Trail Project. Carrie Greenidge is with us here in Studio 2 as part of our local author series. Carrie, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me. This is wonderful.
It's great to have you here. So there's going to be a lot we're going to talk about, but I want to start with one word or sentence. So first, one word or sentence to describe how the world sees the Grimke sisters.
The world sees the Grimke sisters as these quintessential saviors of African-American enslaved people. And yet the Grimke sisters and their family offer a much more complex and complete story of the liabilities of that title.
All right. Now, one word or sentence to describe how you see the Grimke sisters now that this book is done.
I see the Grimke sisters as flawed, and I see them as a microcosm of many of the issues we talk about today when we talk about allyship and we talk about activism.
So this microcosm word, I want to stay with it for a minute, because this book just was stunning.
Thank you. I think
a lot of it, Carrie, was your approach, which is to expand the aperture, right? Widen the picture that we're taking to the community they grew up in, the slaveholding activities of their extended family, to their very complicated, strong at first and then really bad relationships with black abolitionists and with black suffragists, the emergence of their nephews who are born from Charleston and reclaim the family legacy and become part of the black elite in Boston and Philadelphia and D.C. themselves. So they are an actual microcosm. How did you know that was all going to be there for you to write about to paint this complex picture?
Well, I think that when I began researching my previous book on William Monroe Trotter, the Grimke name kept popping up in all of the primary sources and newspapers and family histories. And they were so ubiquitous. And yet, even in these sources from the early 20th century, mostly in the black press and black family histories, there was this talk about the Grimke brothers as separate from the Grimke sisters. And similarly, when I was reading works by white authors, there was a talk of the Grimke brothers as separate from the Grimke sisters. And so I really wanted to, in writing this book, keep my eyes open and my research hat on and really dissecting what did that mean for them at the time, that there's these two parallel sides of a family, each of which receive acclaim in their own time, the Grimke sisters in the 1830s and then the Grimke brothers at the early 20th century. And they know, as all families do, that they are related. And yet there is this idea that they will never or they never talk publicly about that relationship beyond the myth of what that relationship entailed.
All right. So a couple of things there. First, I'll see if we can put a link on our website, radioboston.org, to the conversation that we had with you about your book about William Monroe Trotter, Black Radical, so people can use that for reference. I think the next step, and listen, this is a challenging conversation because there's so much in this book.
Yes.
And we can't paint the 400 pages of the entire book for listeners, but there are a few situations and moments in the book that I think underscore the story you're painting. And one is the details of why and how the Grimke sisters and the Grimke brothers are related. So maybe start there. Do you understand my question?
Yes. I will start with the fact that the Grimke sisters were born in Charleston, South Carolina, to one of the elite slaveholding families of the time. Both of them, by the 1830s, left Charleston and became anti-slavery women's rights activists in the 1830s in the North. And yet they had siblings who remained entwined with slavery in Charleston. One of those siblings was a man who, by all intents and purposes, was depicted, even at the time, as being inherently cruel. His name was Henry Grimke. He was their brother. And he had three sons by an enslaved woman named Nancy Weston. And so it is from Nancy Weston and her relationship, abusive, if not multiple acts of sexual assault, then acts of sexual coercion. The Grimke brothers were the product of that relationship, and they're born on the eve of the Civil War in Charleston, and then are, as the story goes, discovered by their white aunts at the end of the Civil War. And the aunts, Sarah and Angelina Grimke, then took the brothers in when they discovered them attending Lincoln University in Pennsylvania.
So they take two of the brothers, Archibald and Frank, in. We'll make it as an aside now, although it's another interesting storyline. The third brother is not taken in and winds up on a very separate path, both in life and in the story. In what you just said are two themes that come out strongly in the book and are important in our judging today, in this moment, Carrie Greenidge, where we have become committed to telling fuller stories, right? To trying to tell more of the whole story. One of those themes is violence. You and Henry and his relationship with another enslaved person, Stephen, is an iconic understanding of the culture. And you talk about it this way: the culture of particular violence around slavery in Charleston. Tell us a little bit about Henry and Stephen. I think people need to understand what we're talking about.
So Henry was considered a ne'er-do-well by his family. He is sort of undisciplined. He drinks a lot. He attended college in Charleston and eventually returns to Charleston and decides to reclaim, as he called it, his birthright. One of the stories that came out of that background for Henry was his relationship to an enslaved man in the household named Stephen. And this young man was enslaved to in the household from the time he was a little boy and was used as a playmate, a confidant, of course, a forced relationship with Henry. The two grew up together, and Henry, by all accounts, was very violent towards this man, Stephen, banging his head against doors, wantonly abusing him in a very vicious ways, so much so that by the time the two became adults, Stephen suffered from what were called fits at the time and suffered from
traumatic brain injury,
probably we would now call it. And the reaction of the Grimke family to Stephen's ailments was one of disconnect on where that injury came from, at the same time that they talked about the treatment that Stephen suffered at the hands of Henry. This was very well known in the family. And by the time Stephen became an adult, he was considered unsuitable for work in the sort of the gentler way that the Grimkes put it. And eventually the Grimke sisters, again living north at the time, agreed to take Stephen and treat him as free.
Okay, and this is important. So this is another one of the themes that comes out because, you know, I'm mindful of the sound we played of the bridge dedication to the Grimke sisters in Hyde Park. They moved to Hyde Park as it was sort of emerging as a progressive bastion in Boston. One of the things that you talk about is they may have eschewed slaveholding and they may have eschewed some of the wealth that came from that, but they still were given a status and privilege from coming from that background and a family of standing. And they are able to be celebrated as abolitionists and suffragists while they have a man living in their home who is, it appears to be, experiencing epileptic seizures due to the violence that their own brother, who still is enslaving people, and they have the privilege of keeping those worlds separated.
Yes, and I think that's a great way of putting it, the privilege of keeping them separate in their minds. The Grimke sisters, as I talk about in the book, were very good and definitely sincerely believed that slavery was wrong, that it was an evil. They sincerely believed that women should have the ability to speak publicly and politically, and yet they could never reconcile the fact that they benefited from the very system that they disparaged and that they disagreed with and that they hated, and that they themselves were living lives in the shadow of that enslavement. And that in their daily lives, they'd have interactions with African-American people that often went against what they assumed African-American people to be because they were slaveholders. And one of those casualties, of course, was Stephen. And the way they talked about his injury, even though, again, in the background, they're talking about how cruel Henry was to Stephen, and yet they can't understand why Stephen, for instance, can't work.
And I want to be clear, Stephen lived here in Boston.
Yes, he lived. He eventually moved to Boston. They lived in New Jersey for the first part of his life, and then he eventually moved to Massachusetts.
And again, that juxtaposition of what we do and don't know about, for example, that particular family history that we celebrate with our Boston residents.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. So one more theme from that mix, and then I'm going to bring it home. For example, the legacy of Archibald Grimke, one of the Grimke brothers, on Boston itself. But before that, just quickly, Henry enslaved Archibald and Frank's mother. You talk about, we don't know for sure, but it seems likely that their birth was a result of sexual assault and an enslaved sexual relationship.
Yes.
That is another theme you talk about extensively. You take it well beyond the Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings into an entire practice of that time. And the fact that even as Archibald and Frank can come north and Archibald can become a powerful man of standing, Nancy, the mother, can be left behind straddling this old world.
Yes, and I really wanted to make the sexual exploitation of enslaved African-American women a theme and a focus of this book, because the Black Grimkes, of course, would not exist if it weren't for that fact. And so the Nancy Weston, the Grimke brothers' mother, was really forgotten by the Grimke, white Grimke sisters when they, quote-unquote, rescue the Grimke brothers. When they bring the brothers and start to support the brothers as they get educated in the North, Nancy is sort of this afterthought and definitely was not seen as someone who should receive their benevolence.
Despite the fact that they were abolitionists who didn't believe in slavery.
Exactly. Despite the fact that these women were women's rights activists and did not believe in slavery. And so it was really up to the brothers to figure out ways to bring their mother eventually to live with Frank when he became a minister in Washington, D.C. But again, it's sort of this gives this picture of what the limitations of sort of white benevolence in the anti-slavery world and the conflict and the ways in which that conflict manifested itself between African Americans and the white community that claim to support them.
We're talking with Tufts historian Carrie Greenidge about her new book on the famed Grimke sisters, The Grimkes, The Legacy of Slavery in an American Family, here on Radio Boston. All right, so I want to come forward now. And the brothers, they're a next generation. In between is a generation, my words, not yours, of sort of ne'er-do-wells who don't particularly distinguish themselves after these incredibly distinguished sisters. Now come Frank and Archie. They're both interesting, but Archie's Boston. So yes. Let's talk a little bit about Archie, because he then carries forward a different kind of bifurcation that he has a privilege to carry because of his wealth and standing, even if it's in a crunched, suppressed world of Black freedom in Boston versus the world that the Grimke sisters are free to roam in.
Yes, so Archibald Grimke eventually attended Lincoln University. Part of that was supported eventually by the Grimke sisters. They offered money and support. He then attended Harvard University Law School, from which he graduated and one of the first Black graduates of that school. And then he became a very prominent member of Black Boston political circles during the 1870s and 1880s. One of the things he did was he worked on the campaign of various governors. He caught the attention of sort of leading families and leading white politicians in Boston, and eventually became the publisher of something called The Hub, which was a Black Republican newspaper in the 1880s. Eventually, he became a political independent. He argued that the Republican Party had not done enough for African Americans and became a leader in that Black political the independence movement. And then eventually he was appointed by the governor of Massachusetts to be the head of the Westboro State Hospital out in central Massachusetts, and became sort of a leader in turning that into a sort of world-class institution in the state of Massachusetts. So he really was this pioneering leader within the Black elite, not just in Boston, but then that reflected upon the Black elite throughout the North.
And as a member of the Black elite, and I'm mindful I'm going to ask you a complicated question. We've got 40 seconds to answer it. Yes. He actually, in some cases, created liberation, but in some cases, reinforced a different kind of caste system.
Yes, he was a light-skinned, very privileged, wealthy man. One of the ways in which he enacted or reenacted a lot of the lessons of Charleston on the world was he became the ambassador to what becomes the Dominican Republic. And through that ambassadorship, enacted a lot of the same policies and ways of talking about Dominican peasants in the same way that white slaveholders talked about African Americans. So it's sort of a very complicated story of the legacies of slavery, not just in terms of the ways that white reformers looked at Black people, but how Black people looked at themselves.
So Kerry Greenidge, a historian at Tufts University, in two sentences, what do you want people to take away from this book?
History is complicated and our stories are complicated, and it's the complicated stories that give us a fuller picture of the present.
Well, as someone who read it, mission accomplished. Kerry Greenidge, author of The Grimkeys, Legacy of Slavery in an American Family, assistant professor in the Department of Studies in Race, Colonialism, and Diaspora at Tufts University. When are you going to write another book so we can have you back?
Oh, a couple of years. Next one's coming up.
Thanks for coming in.